Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Record numbers of women are running for Congress, and many are winning their primaries in this primary season. This hour, how gender colors our politics, how it has in the past, how it does in the present, and perhaps we'll have a few thoughts about where it's going from here. Joining us for the entire hour, Diane Bystrom. Diane is director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. She's retiring this summer after serving as the center's director for 22 years in our Ames studio. Diane, welcome to what will be your last show as the acting director, current director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We've benefited so many times from your insights over the years. Also joining you in our studio in Ames, Kelly Winfrey, assistant professor with the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University. Hi there again, Kelly.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So gender and politics what we're focusing on this hour. Before we get to what I just announced there, that, you know, more women running for Congress this year in this for these midterms than we have had in the past. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Diane, share a little bit of your thoughts as you are on the eve of your retirement. Perhaps go way back. How did you first get interested in politics and specifically politics and women?
Well, I was raised in a very political household, and so I think that's one thing that was different. Our parents welcomed talking about the day's current events and politics at the dinner table, and I was the oldest of five children, grew up near Omaha. And so my mom was very involved in politics, and I started out as a political reporter for a newspaper and just have always been interested in politics. And so fast forward, I found myself at the University of Oklahoma working for their public relations office instead of at a newspaper. Was interested. I worked in ERA campaigns, Equal Rights Amendment campaigns, both in Nebraska and Oklahoma. Have been a longtime member of the League of Women Voters. And so when I decided to go back to school and get my PhD, I was interested in combining my interest in journalism and communication with politics and got my PhD in communication, specializing in political and mass communication, and did my dissertation research on women versus male political ads on television and also their media coverage. And that just happened to be, by happenstance, in 1992, the year of the woman. And so my dissertation is actually on a very exciting year where a record number of women not only ran for office and won. And so so I started my career with that. And as I was talking to several people, ending my career at Iowa State with another, I think, election in which women are running in record numbers in 2018.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to bookend it that way. That's very interesting. What would you say in briefly, what are you most proud of? Many achievements there at the Carrie Chapman Catt Center. But what do you point to as some of the highlights for you during your 22 years?
Well, I think one of the things I'm really proud of, and when you give an interview at Iowa State, you're expected to give a job talk and have something sort of substantial and interesting to say. And of course, the center was very new when I applied for the director position. It had only been around for 4 years. But one of the things I knew from my own research is that there really wasn't a good collection of women's political speech. And so I thought, what a great fit. I first thought that the Catt Center needed a research focus to get national and international attention. And so I thought, what better thing to do is to have an archive of women's political speech that didn't exist. And I thought it was fitting because Carrie Chapman Catt was such a prolific speaker herself. And so it would be a great fit for the Catt Center. Kelly's actually directing that today, but got that started up. I interviewed in 1996. It took me 10 years to get it started, raising some private money for it. But now we have over 2,000 speeches of about 500 women, both current and historical. And we also started collecting women's political advertisements about 3 or 4 years ago. So it's a very rich archive. It gets like 30,000 hits a month. And so so that's something I'm really proud of because it was sort of an idea that I had and I was able to raise money for it and it's been implemented. And I think it's just a great resource for researchers and it kind of puts us on the map.
And Diane, we will be drawing on that resource a couple of times, two or three times this hour. We have some audio from the Archives of Women's Political Communication. actually, before that, let's throw out a couple of trivia questions that have to do with women in politics. And now, Diane and Kelly, you can't answer. We're trying to get the first email in the door.
Okay.
To see these are not easy. Who was? And this is an email you'll want to direct if you have the answer to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Who was the first woman to be placed in nomination for the presidency at a major party's convention? Quiet, Kelly, Diane.
Okay, I know. We both know.
I know your faces are lighting up. Yeah. The first woman to be placed in nomination for the presidency at a major party's convention. We'll hear her voice later on in the program if you have the answer to that. No Google, be honest, no Googling or Binging or asking Jeeves. You're on your honor. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about this record number of women running for Congress, many winning their primaries. Kelly, start us off there. What are you seeing?
Well, a lot of the work that I've done with the CAT Center is looking at women in Iowa, and we see a record number of women running for the Iowa legislature and executive offices as well. For example, we have 65 women running in this election, in this primary, that are unopposed. And that was the total number in the general election in 2016. So we are guaranteed to have at least as many women in the general election as we did in 2016. And that assumes that all of the women that have opponents were to lose, which is extremely unlikely. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely looking at record numbers. For example, for the Iowa State House, 51 women ran in 2016. That's up to 71 women this year. So a big jump we're seeing in Iowa. You know, we see a lot. We tend to see more women run as Democrats, but we're also seeing an increase in the number of women running as Republicans as well. So it's on both sides of the aisle. Women are getting out there and declaring their candidacies and trying to make a difference in the state. And Diane could probably talk a little bit more about some of those national numbers because she's been looking at that recently.
Right, Diane. And you, what's been making news here is that, well, the redistricting that happened due to the gerrymander ruling in Pennsylvania, and women, they're coming to the fore as never before.
Yes, I think so. You know, what we've been tracking, and again, the Center for American Women in Politics is the oldest university-based center in the United States studying women in politics. We're actually the second oldest at the Carey Chapman CAT Center. And so we do a lot of work with them, and they actually are a great resource for national statistics. They've already declared it a record for women running for the House, which is 309 this year, which beat the previous high of 298 in 2012. Also, they've declared it a record for women running for governorship, with 40 women have filed for governorship, which beats the previous high, which was 34 set back in 1994. So what we're seeing, and they think we're on track to be another record for the U.S. Senate and probably another record for the state legislature. And so, you know, they track this and report when filing deadlines have passed. I think one of the things that we've seen is that, you know, we want to be sort of cautiously optimistic. One of the things that the center director at the Center for American Women in Politics has said is we want to underpromise and overperform, because there's been so much media attention to women. We don't want the narrative to be, you know, that they somehow had some shortcomings when it came to the 2018. But what we know right now is that even the cautious predictions for states like Pennsylvania last Tuesday, also Nebraska next door, had some unpredicted wins by women. And so women are actually, with that caveat that we want to sort of underpromise and overperform, so far women are doing better than expected in the primaries that have been held so far.
Diane, Kelly mentioned that it's pretty much from both parties that we're seeing the influx of women into vying for political office and more local level, state government and so forth. Is that true at the national level, representation in Congress?
Well, no, at the national level and typically at state legislatures nationwide. And this is why I think, you know, centers like the Carey Chapman CAT Center, working on both sides of the aisle, there is an if the women that are in the U.S. Congress and also in state legislatures nationwide and also in Iowa, you know, tend to be 60, 65, up to 70% of the total number of women and Republicans on that lower end of the scale. And so at the national level, there are more Democratic women running than Republican women, except I think when you get a governor. Governor and state executive office have been a good areas for women Republicans to run. And so in that case, you know, they're holding their own there. But I would say nationwide, if you're looking at the U.S. House, there certainly are more Democrats running. But that's not particularly new. That's been something that we've seen really since the late 1980s.
Mm-hmm. And we're seeing more. I think kind of the caveat is there have historically been more women running as Democrats. And that's still true. But we also are seeing Republican women run in higher numbers than they have in previous elections. Mm-hmm.
It's no secret we live in unique political times. Do these things just coincide? Is it a coincidence? More women running for office because of the, let's say, interesting times we live in, or is it somehow connected that you can see from the data?
I'm going to go back to say that I think it is the times that we're living in, and I'm going to go back to, again, 1992 mm-hmm. when I was writing my dissertation. There were a lot of things happening in 1992 that seemed to be replicated in since the 2016 election. One would be in 1991, that's when Anita Hill appeared before the all-white, all-male U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee to with their hearings on Clarence Thomas's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court with the allegations of sexual harassment. And it almost seems kind of impossible now, but at the time, sexual harassment wasn't even very much defined in U.S. law. And so she was bringing charges of her behavior in the workplace. And so that got a lot of women upset. That's why a lot of record, because they thought in watching these nationally publicized hearings that the men just didn't get sexual harassment. And that was men that were Democrats and Republicans. They just didn't seem to get the issue. You had the National Organization for Women and the National Women's Political Caucus get particularly engaged. You also had that year, what is now, I think, still a record number of retirements and resignations. We're getting close mm-hmm. to that number now. But so you had a record number of resignations and retirements from Congress over a banking scandal, actually. And then you also had redistricting in that election. And so mm-hmm. after the 1990 census, you had a lot of redistricting. So what we don't have now is the redistricting. But we do have, I think, like we had in 1992, we have the Me Too movement. So sexual harassment, again, at the forefront of the national conversation. And of course, now we have social media that carries on that conversation and helps organize people. We also have what is nearing to be, again, another record of resignations and retirements. We do have, as you mentioned, some redistricting, not so much because of the census, but because of these gerrymandering cases that have gone to courts. So a lot of open races, which provide opportunities mm-hmm. for women. And Kelly's actually been tracking that in Iowa, the number of women running in open races, and can talk about that, because women win over 50% of the time if it's an open race.
Mm, Kelly, do talk about that. That's interesting. Why would that be?
Well, you know, the big difference is in an open seat race, you don't have an incumbent who people are already satisfied with. And so a lot of times, I think the number is in the 90% range of the amount of time incumbents win their election. So when the incumbent retires, it provides an opportunity for a fresh face, be that a different party or a different gender. And we have a lot of that in this election. We have 23 open seat races in this election, and women are in 18 of those races. That's a big difference, actually, even than 2016. We had 28 open seat races, but only 5 women competing in those. Mm-hmm. So there's an opportunity for when you don't have an incumbent that people are, you know, satisfied with, when it's going to be a new face, it provides women an opportunity to get their foot in the door. I mean, I think a good example of that is Joni Ernst in 2014. We had 2 male senators who'd been there for a very long time. One retired, and it provided a chance for a fresh face, and that happened to be a woman in that case. So we have a lot of opportunities in this state with the number of open seat races and the number of women participating in those races.
If you just joined us, Kelly Winfrey is with us of the Iowa State University Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication, Diane Bystrom of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. Well, I threw out a trivia question. We don't have any answers into our email, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. So I'm just going to go ahead and ask you, Kelly and Diane, you can fight for the answer here. The question was, who was the first woman to be placed in nomination for the presidency at a major party's convention? Let me just turn to you, Diane.
Margaret Chase Smith.
Margaret Chase Smith, a senator from Maine. Let's listen to a little bit of her from the Archives of Women's Political Communication through the Carrie Chapman Katz Center. This is from January of 1964. Senator Smith spoke to the Women's National Press Club in Washington, announcing her candidacy for the presidency. She outlined a number of arguments for her candidacy, including this one.
This argument contends that I would be pioneering the way for a woman in the future, to make her more acceptable, to make the way easier for her to be elected president of the United States. Perhaps the point that has impressed me the most on this argument is that women before me pioneered and smoothed the way for me to be the first woman to be elected to both the House and the Senate, and that I should give back in return that which had been given to me.
Senator Margaret Chase Smith from Maine in 1964. Comment on sort of that half century of change we've had here. Diane, when you reflect on the context, the society, the norms that Margaret Chase Smith was in, having her political office and being the first woman to be placed in nomination for the presidency at a major party's convention.
Well, I think one of the things that strikes me about what she said, and I think Kelly kind of alluded to it a little bit in her previous comments about Joni Ernst, is that, you know, every time a woman, you know, achieves something, it opens the door just a little bit wider for someone to follow in those footsteps. And I think Margaret Chase Smith certainly realized that she had been the beneficiary of women years before her to step into that role of being not only the first woman put in nomination at the Republican National Convention, at a national convention in 1964, but the fact that she was the first woman not only to serve in the House, but in the Senate. And so I think recognizing the women that go before you is one thing that I find that women that are Democrats and Republicans tend to have in common. So I think another thing is just, and I think we see this in the literature today, there's a lot of research that shows that many times women view themselves as not only representing the people in their district or their state, but they see themselves in representing issues of importance to women across the country. And as part of that, actually, other lines of research show that women actually tend to get donations from women across the country. So you might be a woman running in the state of Iowa, but there might be a woman out there in the state of Texas thinking, I think it's really important for Iowa to have, you know, its first woman in the Congress, which came in 2014. And so I think that there is some, you know, sort of, you know, I think with Margaret Chase Smith, it kind of aligns with both of those things, that women are following in the footsteps of other women that have made that path just a little bit easier for them, and that also women feel an obligation in some cases to represent issues outside their district that relate to women and families.
Join our conversation with Diane Bystrom and Kelly Winfrey as we discuss women in politics. What do you think of how gender has colored our politics from the 1960s onward until today? Join our conversation with a question or comment, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Another bit of trivia. We'll hear the voice of this woman a little bit later in the program. Who was the first Black congresswoman and a 1971 candidate for nominee for president? First Black congresswoman, 1971 candidate for presidential nomination. Who was that? River to River at iowapublicradio.org. And let's talk a little bit about what may be happening here with these record numbers. And talking about the record numbers of women running for Congress, does that mean, Diane, that we're going to likely hit a high water mark that we had in 1992? It is something like in our Congress, we have about, roughly 20%?
It's 20% now. It's actually inched up a little bit. There's been women appointed in special elections. So we have, I think, 107 women totally in Congress now, which is overall 20%. And so here's what the thing, you know, in 1992, there was a 69% increase in the number of women in Congress. It went from 32 to 54. So I just did the numbers before the show, and that would mean we'd have to elect 74 more women this year, you know, bringing up that number to over 180. And I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, and so that's, you know, we can't set our sights on that. So, you know, we had a small number in 1992. There were only, I believe, there were four women in the Senate, you know, there were 32 in the House. And so those increases from 32 to 54 overall, 4 to 7 in the Senate, 28 to 47 in the House. Those are small numbers increasing by large percentages. And we're not going to, you know, we're probably never going to see that number again. You know, that's just, it was a large percentage increase because we had very small numbers at that time. So I don't think we're going to see the same thing as we did in 1992. But I do think that we're going to see some historic wins in 2018. And I think we're going to see some wins that perhaps aren't expected. And so I do think we'll have an increase over the 107. There's another thing we kind of need to pay attention to, that we do have a number of women, I think it's 13 or maybe more in the U.S. House, that are not running for re-election because they're running for a higher office. For example, the U.S. Senate, they might be running for another office or they may be retiring. So we already start out with a bit of a deficit in the House that we, from the get-go, we have to replace, I think, 13 women in the House before we even get to, you know, 107. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think that, you know, I think we're going to do well in 2018. But again, to quote my colleagues at the Center for American Women in Politics, this is a marathon and not a sprint. Right. And so I think what we're hoping to do at the CAT Center, we have another Ready to Run workshop coming up in 2019 that Kelly Winfrey directs for the center. We had a record number of 172 women come to our 2017 workshops. So we're really seeing this as a building block. We want to build on this excitement. One of the things that women sometimes do is that they run, and then if they lose, they don't want to run again. And we need to, and men don't do that. And so we need to work with women to be sustained, because I think not only in 2018, but in 2020 and in 2022, which will be after a census year, there's going to be great opportunities for women to increase their representation, not only in the U.S. Congress, but also in state legislatures. And I also think that we're going to see maybe in 2020, certainly some women seeking the nomination for president on the Democratic side. And so I think I see this year as a building block to some exciting years ahead.
Okay. We'll be back in just a moment with Diane Bystrom of the Carrie Chapman CAT Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University, retiring as its director in August. Kelly Winfrey is with us of ISU's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. Women in politics are our topic, and we have a winner for our last little bit of milestones in women in politics, the first Black congresswoman and 1971 candidate for nominee for president. We'll find out when we come back and hear a little bit from this woman as we continue to discuss women in politics. We'd like to have your view. Do you view a female candidate through a different lens than a male? What do you see as the future of women in politics? You know, Europe has something like, some states, some nations have 40% representation. We're around 20. Do you see that changing here in the U.S.? I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this month, Grinnell native, former University of Northern Iowa faculty member, literary critic Lori Rackstra died at the age of 86 in her hometown. Tomorrow on this program, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with Lori Rackstra from 2009. That's when she'd just come out with a memoir about her 42-year-long friendship with Kurt Vonnegut. The book then that came out, titled Love as Always, Kurt Vonnegut as I Knew Him, a book that featured never-before-published correspondence with Kurt Vonnegut. Tomorrow we'll hear that conversation from 2009 with Lori Rackstra, who died earlier this month. Kelly Winfrey is with us of Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication, along with Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics at ISU. We're taking a look at women in politics, considering the record numbers of women running for Congress, many winning their primaries, kind of putting that into historical perspectives. Before the break, I threw out another one of our milestones for women trivia questions. The question, who was the first black congresswoman and a 1971 candidate for nominee for president? And Kelly, I'm going to go to you for the answer. We have a winner here, but what is the answer?
Shirley Chisholm.
Shirley Chisholm. And the first to answer via email was Jennifer Baum. Thank you for writing in so quickly. Honorable mentions to other quick responses out there. Charles, Timothy, Brooke, Paul, and Sherry all wrote in with the correct answer a little bit later than Jennifer. Thanks for being quick on the email. Let's listen to Shirley Chisholm and have you tell us a little bit about her, Diane, after we do. Here she is, years later in October of 1983, speaking in Massachusetts at the Greenfield High School Auditorium. She said that we should be selecting the smartest and most talented people available to solve problems, no matter who they are.
There is no particular test as yet that indicates that man has a superiority of gray cranial matter over women. They're stupid men, and they're stupid women. They're brilliant men, and they are brilliant women. And our country needs the collective talents of the genus Homo sapiens, who have talent, of whom some are men and some are women, in order to be able to better the conditions for all of us.
Shirley Chisholm from 1983. Comment on her. Remarkable woman, Diane.
Well, what I remember most about her, and I think we actually have this video at the Katz Center, but she was known as a campaign slogan of unbought and unbossed. So really independent. And I think that's that clip that you just played about her really shows that. She was the first black congresswoman actually representing New York City's 12th congressional district. She was in the Congress for seven different terms. As you said, she became the first black woman to run for the Democratic Party's nomination for president. And so she really, I do, again, a remarkable woman. And, you know, I think the other interesting thing about it, although the number of women of color is even growing more slowly than the number of women overall, in 2016, we did see one of the upticks of that election is that the number of women in Congress stayed the same after the 2016 election. And we've picked up some seats through basically appointments to men retiring or resigning. And so one of the things that we did see in 2016, even though the overall number of 104 stayed the same, the overall number of women in color actually increased that year. And certainly, you know, tracing that back to Shirley Chisholm and, again, her historic run for president and the fact that she was such an independent and I think is someone who's very much revered today as being a trailblazer.
Mm-hmm. Certainly also a trailblazer. First woman to represent Iowa in the U.S. Congress, first female combat veteran elected to the U.S. Senate from any state. For years, Iowa was only one of a couple of states that had never sent a female to Congress, nor had a woman governor. We have both of those milestones now. Let's listen to a little bit of, you guessed it, Joni Ernst. We won't make this into trivia. It's bit on the easy side, Joni Ernst. She gave her first public speech, this is a bit of it, after launching her campaign in July of 2013 in Ames.
And let me just explain to you why I am running for U.S. Senate. I believe that all of the values that I hold dear, things that I've fought for over 20 years, are being threatened by the failed policies of this president. And that's why I'm running for U.S. Senate. Three things. I am a mother, I am a soldier, and I am a conservative. And as a mother, I want to ensure that my daughter is inheriting the same great nation that we inherited. And I see the president's policies, such as Obamacare, cap and trade, and high taxes, as threatening that.
Okay. Kelly, perhaps you can address that. She ran on this slogan, mother, soldier, conservative. There she has her gender as mother, her role front and center. Interesting.
Yes, I think Joni Ernst is a great example that I use a lot in teaching and some of my writing of a candidate, a female candidate that did a really good job balancing gender stereotypes and gender expectations. A lot of time women struggle if they're seen as too feminine, then they're not seen as strong leaders. But if they're seen as too masculine, then they're kind of evaluated negatively. And Joni Ernst did a really good job balancing that. If you remember back to her primary, she faced, I believe it was a 7-way primary, I think, against all the other candidates were men. And she was emphasized a lot of kind of masculine traits in those ads. That was the, castrating pigs ad. There was one where she was on a motorcycle. And then in the general election.
On a motorcycle going to a shooting range.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So really kind of countering negative gender stereotypes in that primary election, and then was a little more feminine in the general election by emphasizing that mother role, but also the fact that she was a soldier. So just in her slogan, she did a great job kind of adapting to those gendered expectations that voters still have, especially in elections where they don't know a whole lot about a candidate. We know that gender can influence people's perceptions. And she really used that to her advantage and negotiated those kind of negative stereotypes really well.
Mm-hmm. And that turned out, Kelly, to sort of inoculate the press against going to stereotypes, if I can put it that way. Is that correct?
I think that's certainly true. It's kind of, you know, it's really difficult to talk about her not being strong whenever she's a soldier.
Commanded troops in Iraq.
Exactly. And then also, you know, with those primary ads, too, being on the farm and riding motorcycles and those sort of things. So in some ways inoculated the press, but also demonstrated to voters that she had a variety of traits that we look for in leaders, both masculine and feminine traits.
Kelly Winfrey is with us of Iowa State University, as well as Diane Bystrom, talking about women in politics, larger theme of gender in politics. Diane, later this year, I understand you have a study coming out in another book on Hillary Clinton's newspaper coverage. This is during the 2016 campaign?
Yes. I actually did it with a graduate assistant in the Greenlee School. And it's going to be in a book that comes out later this year that's mainly about the Donald Trump presidency and political communication. But they asked me to write a chapter about Hillary Clinton. And so at the time, when I first agreed to do so, I thought, gosh, I bet a lot of people have done studies about her coverage. And at the time I wrote it, which was, gosh, I think I got it done in January. There really hadn't been a lot studied that was from a gendered perspective. I couldn't find any. I'm sure there's others under the works right now. So we looked at her newspaper coverage in four major newspapers, the Washington Post, New York Times, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal. And the previous studies that had looked at her research done at Harvard University by Tom Patterson, primarily there, had looked at the negativity of her coverage as compared to Donald Trump's, and also some look at the policy emphasis, and so he had done that. So I decided to bring in what research has told us in the past about gendered coverage. And so I looked at things like mentions of her family, mentions of her appearance. And I did another thing looking at, because the election was tied so much to constituencies, we looked at mentions that stories that mentioned either African-Americans in her coverage, Latinos, and white working class voters. And so of the interesting things I think we found is that there was so much narrative about her using identity politics in 2016. But what we found in our study is that she was just as likely to be mentioned in stories, equally likely to be mentioned in stories that talked about white working class men. Of course, they were talking about Trump about that, but that was also part of the narrative, as is women. And so, and we actually found very little linkage to Hillary Clinton with African American voters or Latino voters in her news coverage. And we also looked at the issues that she was linked with, and hardly any mentions of her linked to healthcare. And so we were really pretty surprised about, and we did conclude with our study that she received not only negative coverage, which other studies had shown, but she had received really gendered coverage in her 2016 campaign.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, you're saying, when you say gendered coverage, meaning
Well, what we found, so what we took is that things that research has found in the past. And the good news for women, you know, when I started doing my research on the 1992 election, there were lots of differences in women's coverage, where they, whatever race they were running for. So they were covered more in terms of their image than their issues. They were covered much more in terms of their appearance, including what their hair looked like, what they were wearing. And so that kind of, they were covered in terms of mentions of their families, mentions of their appearance. And so what we, and those things have gone away. So women running, you know, primarily women running now for governor and the U.S. Congress, get pretty equitable coverage in terms of how they're covered with men. What researchers have found, however, is that that is not true for women running for vice president like Sarah Palin in 2008. And Kelly actually has a very well-researched study that was published in a journal on that. And also I did some writing in 2008 and also 2016 on Hillary Clinton. So what we're finding is these old gender stereotypes are being talked about. You know, for example, Bill Clinton was mentioned in nearly, you know, a high percentage of her coverage. So she got mentions of her husband, and it could be because he's a former president, but mentions of her husband, mentions of her appearance, and then, you know, that were kind of at these levels that we actually saw in the early 1990s. And so,
right. But is there, I mean, the winner of the presidency, Donald Trump, plenty of comments, disparaging comments about his appearance and so forth.
Not as significantly so. I mean,
you think?
It's you know, that's the interesting thing is that, and really what dominated the coverage of Hillary Clinton's appearance was questions about her health. And so that would have been in that category. So if you even look at this, if you compare that, there weren't as many questions about Donald Trump's overall health.
And there were, I mean, there were certainly a lot of, I'll just chime in, certainly a lot of comments on, you know, late night comedy and stuff about Donald Trump's appearance, but not in his news coverage in print media or local evening news, those sort of things.
Yeah, Kelly has a great point. We know that in the narrative sort of on the late night TV, but when you're looking at newspaper and television coverage, there wasn't the same type of comments about his his hair or his appearance, and certainly not his health. The other thing researchers have found, and we found as well, is that you know, Hillary Clinton was told to smile all the time, and so was Carla Fiorina, you know, when they were both running for the nomination. So they, you know, I did a whole chapter in an earlier book. I have a chapter out in Gender and Elections that's on the 2016 election, and I always write the communication chapter for that book, and it's out in this fourth edition. And so one of the things I talked about in that book is how often, you know, pundits on TV would tell Hillary Clinton that she didn't smile enough or she smiled too much.
And, or she was yelling.
And she was yelling. And,
also,
yeah.
Also, the candidate Trump commenting on the appearance of Carly Fiorina.
Yes. Yeah.
What was the comment? Something like,
look at that face.
Look at that face. Can you imagine that as a president or something
she
like that?
She turned it into a great ad, though.
Well, she did a great job responding to it in that debate, too. It was very, very good.
Okay, let's go to a caller quickly before the hour ends. Janice is in Iowa City. Welcome to the program. Janice, I see on my screen you're actually running for office in a primary currently, huh?
I am, yes. I'm running for the state Senate. And I'm also speaking as someone who took a couple of the Ready to Run seminars and really appreciated what I learned there. So thank you, Kelly, very much. My comment is that I think that one of the reasons that we're seeing so many women, and particularly qualified progressive women, run for the state legislature this year, which you did mention earlier, is that so many of the issues that have been on the table over the past couple of years at the state legislature disproportionately affect women who are not equally represented there. For example, the ratio in the state Senate is 7-1 right now, men to women. And I think that's one of the things that's pushed so many of us to run.
Mm. Interesting comment. Janice, let's hear from Kelly or Diane. What about that?
I think that's a great point. I mean, when we look at some of the public meetings or committee meetings on some of these issues, like even the fetal heartbeat bill, you see a lot of white men talking about issues that largely affect women. And like in 1992, whenever the kind of the optics of Anita Hill testifying in front of a committee of men raised people's awareness that there was an absence of women, I think with some of the issues we've talked about recently, both with the fetal heartbeat bill, but also with issues like Medicaid and managed care, tend to also affect women more since they tend to be caregivers more often. So these are issues that are particularly important to women citizens And when you look at, you know, the pictures on the news or in the Des Moines Register about what's going on in the state legislature, you're not seeing as many women at the table making decisions about those issues.
Mm-hmm. To carry Janice's point a little bit further, let's just play a what if. And I know, Diane, you said this is a big what if, not a realistic what if. But we do have European countries with 40-some percent representation of women in their parliaments in that case. If we had, say, double the percentage of women in office in our country, in our state legislatures, than we have now in the 40 or 50%, what are the ways in which our politics would change? In other words, what are the issues that concern women that would tend to come to the fore, Diane?
Well, I think, as Kelly was alluding to, is that we'd have more issues that I think gun control would be one of them. I think the fact that I think health care would be another issue. One of the things that we saw after 1992, there had been pieces of legislation like the Family and Medical Leave Act that were just kind of dying on the vine in the U.S. Congress. And when there was enough women elected after 1992, which, you know, again, only 54, but they were able to push through the Family and Medical Leave Act in 1992. They appropriated more money for breast cancer research after 1992. They approved a woman business entrepreneurial business program after 1992. And so I think that there's some pieces of legislation that with bipartisan support of women being elected in those kind of numbers would run through. You know, the bottom line is when people ask me about what difference does it make, well, it makes a difference because we're a representative, you know, to be a representative democracy, we need to be representative of our population, and our population is over 50% women. You know, when I talk to students, I also talk about being more representative in terms of occupations. I mean, and it's, you know, I think we need people in office, both from rural and urban America, representing the sciences. One of the things that we're seeing this year, and I don't have numbers on it because there's been stories, we're seeing more school teachers running for elected office this year, mainly because you've seen in these states these huge cuts to education, especially K through 12. And so you've got school teachers that are running. We have actually more female veterans. My daughter's a veterinarian. Veterinarians out there, you need to run for office as well.
ISU is a great school.
Yeah, and they are actually graduated from Iowa State. But anyway, but more women veterans are running for political office, both Democrat and Republican. And again, you know, we might say Joni Ernst kind of opened the door on that. And as Kelly was talking about, the opportunity to talk about being a woman, but also a soldier, being, you know, that tough but caring. And then, you know, I would say also apparently there are more from the LGBTQ community running. And so there's just a lot of people, I think, that have been felt out or marginalized in this current environment that are running for office. And that's a good sign, because what could happen is that they could feel like there isn't, you know, there isn't any hope and there isn't any change. And so I think the fact that we have a large number of people running for office and young people, a larger number of young people, too.
Mm-hmm. I'll add a couple things to that, too. I think there's a interview that I show students in my Women in Leadership class that Diane Sawyer did after the 2014 election with the record number of female senators, so women senators from both parties. And she asked a similar question about how would things be different if it was 50% women? And they responded, we wouldn't be talking about things like birth control. You know, we would be talking about things like taxes and health care and these issues that affect both men and women. But that's kind of the second thing, is that having a representative democracy, having people that have had life experiences like you, lead them to look at issues differently. And through women's life experiences, they might see certain issues differently than men do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have about a minute left. We haven't mentioned the governor's race we have coming up. Current Governor Kim Reynolds, not elected to the governor's position, elected to the lieutenant governor, appointed to governor when Terry Branstad became ambassador, U.S. ambassador to China. So we have Kim Reynolds, who's going to be facing one of the Democratic rivals, depending on the primary there. What are each of you looking at? We have a couple minutes there in that campaign to come. Diane?
Well, I think, you know, the one thing, we have a lot of candidates right now. A new Seltzer poll came out the other day showing a pretty tight race on the Democratic side. A lot of candidates, and they're staying in the race. I think that's, you know, one thing that has, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but sometimes, you know, at this point in time, some of the candidates that aren't getting as much money are dropping out. But certainly, I think what's going to happen, and this is actually something that benefited Joni Ernst in 2014, is that she was battle-tested in the primary. Mm-hmm. And so that actually ended up being a great advantage for her when she ran against Bruce Braley in the general election. You know, Kim Reynolds will come in with an incumbent advantage. She was not elected, but she has been in office. But that brings with it a record, too, not only that she can talk about in a good way and to promote, but also the Democrats to try to take down. And so I think whoever emerges from the Democratic primary is really going to be battle tested. And I think it's going to be a very competitive race.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Quick word, just a few seconds for your post-retirement plans, Diane, before we say goodbye.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm moving to Nebraska. I'm going to live south of Omaha, but I'm staying involved in some a committee on Iowa State and also a statewide committee that will organize a celebration of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Well, it sounds like hopefully you'll accept our future invitation to be on this program again.
Absolutely.
Okay. Diane Bystrom, director, soon to be former director of the Kerry Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. Kelly Winfrey with us as well of the ISU's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication. Diane and Kelly, thank you so much for coming into our studio to talk about women, gender in politics. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Natalia Reyes helped as well today on our program. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.